Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, the Northern Watershed Project. There's not much left in Alberta in the way of pristine wilderness. That's why researchers are studying the Kakwa region near Grand Prairie. They want to know what's there in terms of fish and fish habitat before oil, gas, and logging companies put too heavy a footprint on this forested landscape. And historian Michael Payne continues his story about the atom bomb that almost blasted the tar out of the bitumen deposits near Fort McMurray. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Flying over the Kakwa watershed near Grand Prairie, you'd almost think you were transported back in time. As far as the eye can see, the hills and valleys are covered with a near-solid mass of spruce and pine. It won't stay that way for long, however. Oil, gas, and logging development has already started at the edge of the Kakwa. That's why researchers are busy in the Kakwa, Simonette, and Notatiquin watersheds. With the help of funding from industry, they are documenting what the aquatic and riparian resources are like in these regions to better manage the inevitable human impact. My first stop is at Red Rock Creek, a tributary to the Kakwa River. Dr. Gary Scrimgeour of the Alberta Research Council and Paul Velgaard of the Alberta Conservation Association are sampling the stream for fish. And as Paul describes, for this survey, they are using a handheld electroshocker.
It's actually quite a dangerous operation. There's not so much a chance of out and out electrocution. It's more of a danger of, and a good analogy would be jump-starting your heart with booster cables, and it sends your heart into a real unnatural rhythm, and that can cause problems. But we're very careful. Very important to stay dry. Very important to stay on the lookout for your partner. We watch each other quite closely, and if anyone goes down, we have a lot of safety switches on the machine. If it tips forward, it goes off automatically. Plus, if we lift our hand off of the switch, it turns the machine off as well.
What's it look like?
Well, it's basically a standard backpack frame. It's actually made by Coleman, but it's really just a power box. It's ran by a 24-volt battery system, and really all it does is jump the power up to a certain level where it has a certain effectiveness in the water. The fish are initially attracted to the electrical field, and then they're temporarily stunned, and allows the dip netter time to dip net them. And once we dip net them, we carry the fish in a pail with us, so they're out of the electrical field, and we can carry them to the end of the reach well where we can process them. Power on?
Power on.
So really what we do, we get into our stream. We sort of have a pre-survey to identify any potential hazards for wading and whatnot, deep places, places where we can't see the bottom. But for the most part, if we're using the backpack system, it's all wadeable. We it's very important that we wear our felt bottom boots so we have a good traction on the stream bed. And really, we just work in an upstream fashion, and we activate the system in and around likely holding spots, all these little plunge pools below the big boulders, the deep holes in around here. Fish like these woody debris piles and the root wads, but we generally apply power to the whole section of river, and that means going back and forth, working in an upstream fashion until we get to the top end of our reach.
Up, bull trap.
Get him?
Got him.
Normally when we capture a fish, we deactivate the system just to minimize the stress inflicted on the fish. And then once we get them out of the water and we put them into a recovery pail full of fresh, cold, clean water, and they bounce back, and they're fighting mad within a couple of minutes, and they go back into the system in good shape. We've captured lots of fish over the years, and our mortality is way below 1% of our catch. You ready, Gary?
After the two biologists sweep this reach of river, Dr. Gary Scrimgeour hauls a bucket of about 60 fish onto the rocky banks of the creek.
We've got, looks like about six species. We have rainbow trout, arctic grayling, whitefish. We have bull trout and slimy sculpin.
What does that tell you about the richness of this stream?
Well, for the Kakwa watershed as a whole, this is actually quite a diverse assemblage. So it's characteristic of good habitat and diverse complexity and good water quality.
What will you do now that you've caught these fish?
We'll anaesthetize the fish. Then we'll take a total length to quantify the fish size. We'll identify the fish. We'll probably make some comments in terms of sort of fish condition with the pre-reproductives or post-reproductives or juveniles or immatures. We'll record all these data and then we'll return the fish to the habitat from which we caught them.
How does all this fit into the study that you're doing?
The overall objective of the work in the Kakwa as well as in the Simonette is to evaluate the cumulative effects of watershed disturbances on fish communities. And when I'm meaning disturbances, I'm meaning the cumulative effects of oil and gas activities such as pipelines, seismic lines, well sites, right-of-ways, in addition to some of the forest harvesting effects. And lower in the watershed, in the Simonette, we're also looking at the effects of oil and gas forestry as well as expansion of the agricultural lands.
What are some of the things that affect them?
Well, fish community is actually reasonably specific to the type of habitat, also gradients in terms of water temperature and dissolved oxygen. Stream size is also strongly influencing fish community structure, so that fish communities lower in the watershed tend to be different compared to those that are in the upper reaches. And this is largely a function of how permanent the water is, how cold it is, the types of stream gradients and the habitat set that provides.
What's the level of industrial activity at this point in the Kakwa?
The Kakwa shows a moderately low gradient of disturbance. It's probably towards the low end, but certainly probably in 10 or 15 or 20 years, it's probably going to more likely resemble that of the Simonette, which has a disturbance gradient which approximately goes from relatively pristine to moderately intensively developed.
Who's this fellow?
This is an arctic grayling, and they're very characteristic because of the dorsal fin. It's a species that's really quite important in the watershed in that it spawns during the spring. So when the floodwaters are coming through, that's a cue for it to go upstream into these smaller tributaries where it will reproduce before dropping back into the larger streams. The young will come out of the sediment and emerge, and they'll basically grow in these small water streams before dropping back into larger systems. One of the important things about the cumulative effects work is that we're really trying to establish the extent to which spawning migrations, such like arctic grayling or bull trout, are impeded by culverts. And our expectation is that culverts can actually serially discontinue stream systems, and that they cut them up into smaller units and largely can affect sustainability because it reduces the ability of adult fish to go upstream and spawn.
The next day, I have a chance to see some of the bad culverts firsthand as Paul and I stand in a small stream a few kilometers up the road from the research camp.
We're on another tributary to the Kakwa River. Where it enters the Kakwa River, it's quite a large stream, and this is near the headwaters section. But we came here to look at this road crossing where it crosses the creek and do a little examination of the culvert itself. We come here. First of all, we identify it with global position system equipment that identifies where it's at on the Earth, allows us to bring it into the geographical information system. And once we do that, we sort of do a real basic assessment, namely what type of crossing it is, whether it be a bridge or a culvert or a log field. There's quite a variety of different crossing types. In this case, it's a culvert. This is a very old road, and the culvert's been installed incorrectly. We can see that the culvert isn't on top of the stream bed itself. It sits on top of the stream bed. And what this has created, it's created a barrier to upstream fish passage. And we can see how nice the habitat looks here. It's all very clean substrates and nice cobbly and gravel substrates. But what this has done, it's fragmented the habitat and it's eliminated access to the upstream side of the bridge for fish for spawning and over-rearing. And what it has done is just eliminated a whole lot of available stream that fish could potentially inhabit.
Well, it looks like it's hanging and the water's coming down just like a waterfall.
That's very true. And what this causes, it's the fish aren't able to make that jump from the stream bed up into the culvert. And even if they were able to make it into the culvert, it's so shallow inside that culvert for such a long distance, they wouldn't be able to swim through the length of the culvert either. So A, they can't get up into the culvert, and B, they would probably be unlikely to navigate through the length of the culvert anyways.
Have you done measurements here?
Yes, we've done a full formal fish survey here last year, and one of the real interesting things that we found was that there was quite a number of bull trout living in the downstream portion of the crossing here, and a number of other species, sculpin, whitefish, and grayling. And we repeated the survey on the upstream side of the culvert, and the upstream side was totally void of fish. And that clearly suggests that this culvert that's preventing upstream fish passage has eliminated the whole presence of fish on the upstream side. And this is a very tiny spot in the watershed, but this is going on throughout this watershed and a lot of other watersheds in northern Alberta.
Right now, Paul, we're standing in the middle of the stream and we're looking down through the culvert, except you can't really see through it, can you? What's the problem here?
Yeah, there's a large problem here. Obviously, the culvert's collapsing. It's bowed downward towards the stream bed. This is a real big concern. One problem that may occur is that the culvert's going to collapse to the point where fish can't get through, but more than likely the road's going to collapse to the point where it's going to crush the culvert, and it's going to cause a lot of flooding on the upstream side. And if there's a strong enough rain event, it's going to wipe the road out, and we're going to be left with a whole lot of silt intrusion into this stream bed.
Gary, we're standing at this hanging culvert. How does this fit into the cumulative effects part of the project that you're studying?
Well, this is a classical type of barrier that we know exists. In effect, this culvert, which seems to be both poorly designed as well as eroded through time, has actually been impeding fish migration for 17 years that we know of. And so this is a good example of where some sort of action is required. And the overall challenge is that when you take this barrier and add them to other barriers that are upstream, what you might be getting is a sequence of partial barriers that when you put them together, the cumulative effect is that it actually stops all upstream migration. And this is a type of area that we just don't understand well at all. But clearly it's crucial if we're going to maintain fish populations in these types of streams.
Even though the Kakwa is relatively untouched, there are already 53 industrial players working there, some with just one or two well sites each. But they all need roads, and it doesn't take long for the impact to accumulate. Another researcher involved in the Northern Watershed Project is Dr. Phil Lee. He has just left the Alberta Research Council to join the Integrated Landscape Management Team at the University of Alberta. His research in the Notikewin and Kakwa watersheds involves an overview of the management philosophies that govern riparian zones.
The riparian zone, in succinct terms, is an ecotone between the upland area and the aquatic zone. And the aquatic zone can be lakes or streams, and it's that land strip immediately beside the lake or stream. And it varies in width depending on what organisms you're dealing with.
What would be the significance, then, of focusing this type of research on it? How is it that we view riparian zones?
In general, we have a great amount of value attached to the riparian zone. It's one of sort of the oldest conservation zones, in fact, we have. And the standard sort of management policy around the riparian zone is a protection, preservation type of zone, meaning no activity within that zone, no industrial activity, no disturbance, man-made disturbance activity. The general philosophy we've had over the last few decades has been to separate any upland activities from the aquatic zone by a provision of a no-touch riparian zone.
In doing the literature review and looking at the policies and that, what have you found during this review?
Well, we found that there are basically sort of two types of philosophy, and the traditional philosophy I've alluded to already, which is a protection-preservation type of philosophy that separates upland activities from the aquatic and riparian area. And basically we do that by a buffer strip, an area that is not touched by industrial or human activity. The second type of philosophy, which is sort of gaining some attention, is to try to introduce a type of dynamic succession, if you will, into the riparian zone, recognizing that riparian zones are not static ecological entities through time, but rather are disturbances that occur with them, both natural and perhaps we should put man-made disturbances in there if, in fact, we've taken out the natural disturbances. And that's sort of gaining some attention in terms of research. It hasn't really been translated into a management philosophy and then into regulations, but it's receiving some attention.
Well, looking at this this second sort of management issue when you're dealing with the riparian zone, how would that actually work? Who would be interested in changing the way that we deal with riparian zones at this point?
If stands are cut with riparian buffer strips, the logging companies won't be back until the second cut in the rotation. Hence, those riparian strips are now considerably older than the adjacent upland stands. And if you look at the evidence with fire or wildfire patterns, one tends to find that riparian zones, yes, do burn less than the upland zones, but they burn nonetheless. And the question is, for managers, should they introduce that type of disturbance into the riparian zone through logging? Now, it's a fairly contentious issue, and there are a number of areas of contention, and I can go through three of them at least. And the first one is, obviously, logging is not fire. There are major differences between logging and fire, particularly when one starts to look at the stand level. The biggest difference between the two is, in fact, the removal of carbon. In logging, we take away the large carbon sources, which are the trees themselves. That's the whole purpose behind logging. Wildfires, while they burn a lot of duff and a lot of green material and fine debris, tend to leave a lot of the large carbon, basically tree trunks, behind. If you walk through a fire, as a Chisholm fire this year, you'll see a bunch of blackened stems. And those blackened stems actually have a fair amount of ecological value. There are early successional communities, fire-dependent communities, that are dependent upon the high densities of snags and the type of environment in wildfires. So logging is not like fire. At a landscape level, though, logging is similar to fire in that it regenerates the stand. It starts a stand off from time zero, and from that point it ages. And the effects, or the differences, I will say, between logging and fire tend to decline as one moves from to 10 years to 20 years to 30 years away from the point of disturbance. There's a lot of differences initially. Those differences become much more subtle as we move away in time. The second bone of contention is whether or not we have actually got a handle on wildfires. And as judged by our fire records on the total productive land base, and as evidenced, you know, as early as this spring and potentially this fall, wildfire is still a large threat and still a large disturbance on the landscape. We haven't, as it were, pulled wildfires off the landscape and substituted or are forced to substitute with some sort of man-made disturbance like logging or prescribed burning. So in that case, have we just doubled the amount of disturbance within an area? And the third issue is, do we want to introduce, as a society, as a policy, disturbances around the aquatic zones? One could argue that we want a fairly constant type of water supply, and that would be best given to us by a preservation protection system, as opposed to a dynamic system of management where there would be ups and downs, basically, in the quality of the water. Over the long term, what we'd hope as researchers and as managers is that we would, in fact, allow a dynamic system to be healthier. But certainly in the short term, if you introduce disturbances to aquatic systems, there's a potential for a degradation of the water quality and riparian zone in the short term. So those are three contentious issues that need to be looked at in terms of research and evaluated, too, in terms of public policy and public reaction.
Looking at the buffer strips that are left and the regulations that say you shall leave a buffer strip of, say, 30 meters or 100 meters, are those actually serving any purpose at this time? Are the ecosystems or the animals, the wildlife that use that riparian habitat, are they benefiting from that?
They are, because it does provide corridors and it does provide habitat that is older within a matrix of younger stands. And one of the larger problems that we have in terms of logging is traditionally the loss of older stands. So even if they weren't near water, they would provide an older habitat. Most riparian zones are corridors. In fact, it provides shelter through corridors. They also provide shade for the stream. They provide a certain amount of buffering for sedimentation and erosion, and downwind material inputs into the stream. There's a whole list of functions, ecological functions, that occur in buffer zones that are maintained through preservation protection. The question again, though, is in a system that's naturally dynamic with wildfires, floods, insects, should man, in fact, push some of those dynamic zones? And how resilient are our riparian ecosystems to those sorts of changes? And should we have dynamic changes in that system?
Thank you very much, Phil.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Phil Lee, a research associate at the University of Alberta and formerly with the Alberta Research Council. Other partners in the Northern Watershed Project include TransCanada Pipelines, Diashawa Marubeni, Manning Diversified Forest Products, and Alberta Pacific Forest Industries. Coming up, atomic bombs in the oil sands. After the United States government announced Project Plowshares in the 1950s, one of the proposals that came forward for the peaceful use of nuclear energy was suggested by Dr. L. M. Natland of the Richfield Oil Company. He figured he could detonate a small atomic bomb under the Athabasca oil sands and then pump out the oil. Historian Dr. Michael Payne continues this tale of technological absurdity.
Well, the Alberta government was actually approached for the first time, along with the federal government, in June of 1958 with this idea. Richfield Oil and Natland were in partnership with Imperial Oil and City Service Athabasca Incorporated because those were the leaseholders on the area where they wanted to engage in this experiment. And the companies together approached both the provincial and the federal government in June 1958. The first meetings were really technical. They took place between Natland and representatives of Richfield Oil and essentially senior civil servants and government regulators at both the federal and provincial levels. It wasn't until January 1959 that the idea was formally presented to Premier Manning and his cabinet, and later that month their federal counterparts were also briefed on what was being discussed as well. Alberta appointed a technical review committee almost instantaneously, which was consisted of the leading scientists in this area in Alberta. It also included the Minister of Economic Affairs, the Deputy Minister of Mines and Minerals, and I think rather interestingly, for a very brief time before he resigned from this committee, Grant McEwen, who was there as a representative of the official opposition. McEwen actually would resign in June of 1959 and had nothing further to do with this particular scheme.
Where did they plan to set off the bomb?
Well, let me explain a little bit what they were thinking about here. The site that was proposed was a well site on Pony Creek, not far from the railway siding at Chard, which was on the Northern Alberta Railway line going up to Fort McMurray. The general theory behind it was that you would set off a small nuclear device. This was, we should probably note, a very small device that they were talking about, relatively speaking, at 9 kilotons. It was supposed to be set off in the rock underneath the oil sands, and the idea was, like the underground explosions in Nevada, that the explosion would essentially vaporize the rock and create a large cavity into which heated oil sand material would tumble. And by the mixture of the kind of the heat and the creating of this cavity, it was hoped that, in fact, you would be able to pump the bitumen out using conventional technology as opposed to trying to use steam-assisted gravity drainage or any of the other current in-situ methods that are being used away from the mining areas of the oil sands. So the idea was essentially to create something that roughly parallel a more conventional oil well. And they did think based on some initial work that had been done with the underground explosions in Nevada, that problems of things like radiation would be not insurmountable technologically. There was some feeling, and it comes out in the reports, that much of the radiation would be caught and entrapped in the vaporized rock, which would then become like a glassy film or ceiling or seal in the cavity, and that a lot of the radiation would actually be captured there and would be not come out into the bitumen and so on, and that most of the remaining radiation would be relatively unstable and therefore would not remain around. It would have a very short half-life. Whether or not they are accurate in those assumptions is another matter.
Was there any public debate at this time over this issue?
There was some. There are a couple of reasons, I think, for why the federal government began to kind of back away from this idea. One was increasing debate in Canada over radiation and the negative consequences of nuclear power. Part of it was the climate of the times, the huge public discussion and enormous anxiety over the threat of nuclear war in the early 1960s that leads up to the Cuban Missile Crisis. And then a whole series of international agreements from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaties to the banning of underground nuclear testing and so on in the 1960s as well that really did end the project politically, if not technically.
You would think that that would have brought everything to an end, but the whole idea was brought up again, wasn't it?
In the early 1970s, this idea was reinitiated. There is, in fact, a patent which was applied for, which is entitled A Process for Stimulating Petroliferous Subterranean Formations with Contained Nuclear Explosions, and the patent was granted in 1971. And in 1973, there was a brief flurry of interest led by a Canadian oil company called Phoenix Oil, which proposed to do something similar to Project Oil Sand in the Athabasca Formation. But this time around, the project really went nowhere.
Thank you very much, Michael.
My pleasure.
That was historian Dr. Michael Payne. And thanks to the Alberta Historical Resources Foundation for sponsoring this Science Heritage segment of Innovation Alberta. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Check out our website. You can listen to past programs in real audio or download them from the web. That's at innovationalberta.ckua.com. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.